This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Taking you back to the Allen Border Field in Brisbane at 1 o'clock today, so we'll pick up where you've just left off with that cricket match, the Australian women playing Sri Lanka, and back to the game, as I said, at 1 o'clock today. Between now and the news at one, we're talking about sheep prices, taking you over to Ballarat for a little bit and just to check in on prices there, where sheep mutton prices sort of between $6 to $7 a kilo and in some cases over that $7 mark. And apparently those prices being driven up by what's going on in China in the wake of the African swine fever, kind of wiping out all of those pigs and leaving China in a situation where they've got to find protein from somewhere else. So they're looking for more sheep meat. So we'll look at the sale yard situation in the east, but also here at Katanning too. Tracy Kilner is going to run through the details, and just had a quick chat to her before coming to talk to you today. And she was sort of saying that, you know, if we're looking at heavy weathers at Katanning today, somewhere between $3.96 and $4.40 per kilo. So not quite those heady hikes of $7 at Ballarat. But we'll go through the details with Tracy just before the news at 1 o'clock. And also, did you get to the Landor races this year? I knew a few people heading off this year, including our reporter, Michelle Stanley. So she'll give you a little flavour of the races this year. But if you went along, or if you have been along over the years, send me through a text of your most memorable moment, perhaps, or what makes you go there? What's the big appeal for you? Let me know. 0448 922 604 if you'd like to text through your memories of the Landor races, or particularly if you went over the weekend. Now, yesterday, remember we were talking about Australian fast food giant Hungry Jack's, which has launched a plant-based alternative that tries to mimic the taste and texture of its beef burger. The legume-based patty is the creation of plant-based meat company V2 Food, which is a joint venture between the CSIRO and the fast food chain's founder, Jack Cowan. The startup is led by Nick Hazel, and he says the plant-based meat movement, it isn't about vegans or vegetarians. The main focus is actually meat eaters that are concerned with sustainability.
I actually went to a conference in San Francisco around alternative proteins, and I felt very uncomfortable. I was talking to a lot of CEOs around the opportunity and what people were doing and trying to figure out what was going on and what this opportunity was. And I couldn't put my finger on what was making me feel so uncomfortable. I woke up at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning, jet lag, and I figured out what it was. It was that I was the CEO of a startup in this space in a room full of 200 other startups, and I reckoned that I was the only non-vegan. And it occurred to me that this opportunity is not around the vegan opportunity. It's actually for meat eaters and meat lovers. And it's not about converting people to veganism and to vegetarianism. It's about giving people who love meat a choice to do something which is a little bit better for them and for the planet. So that was, for me, a big aha. It's a global phenomenon. I think that what's happening is that people realize that globally, the increased consumption of meat is not sustainable. When you combine the fact that the population is growing towards the 10 billion and that meat consumption is also growing per capita, when you do the maths, it's actually impossible for us to feed the planet with that amount of meat into the future. And that kind of says, well, there's got to be another planet's worth of meat that needs to be grown somehow. So this is the impetus behind this whole movement.
What is the science behind creating plant-based burger patties? What are they made from?
Well, essentially, it starts with a legume. What you do then is you extract the protein and some of the fiber, and then you use that to form a structure, which is the basic structure of your meat. What we've done is looked at what the flavor systems there are in meat. CSIRO have got 20 years of knowledge and expertise in meat flavor, and then you recreate that into the patty. So what happens is that when you cook the meat, it behaves exactly the same way as beef, and those lovely sort of beef flavors are developed as you cook the meat. to give you something which really is indistinguishable from the animal-based product.
There has been some pushback from beef producers who say that products like this that are attempting to replicate or mimic the texture and the taste of beef are shortchanging the beef industry, who's worked for many years to establish a brand and market presence. What do you think about that?
I think this is about, if you think globally, Australia exports a lot of meat around the world. If you look around the world globally, there's an enormous increase in meat consumption, particularly in Asia, where actually Australia is benefiting from exporting to these countries. We can't support any more cattle within Australia. You know, we're pretty much at the maximum, or until recently, obviously, recent events we have. But we're pretty much at capacity. If we grow plant-based meat, you could imagine that we could be doubling, tripling our exports to the rest of the world of Australian-grown animal and plant-based meat. So I look at this as an absolute win for Australia, for the Australian meat industry. And the reality is a lot of farmers, they do mixed cropping. And getting a good price for your legumes, which you use to restore the soil, you rotate, you look after the soil, you grow your animals, you grow your grains. You can create a great sustainable system, which many farmers actually already do. So we really don't look at it as a win-lose. This is a win-win.
It was kind of being marketed under the phrase better for you and better for the planet. Is a meat substitute actually of the same or better nutritional value as beef?
No, I think that, well, if you can manufacture, it's like with everything, you can make great products or less good products. I think that our game and our intention, and this is with our help again from CSIRO, is to match the good things that there are in meat. And meat is a really valuable source of protein. It's a valuable source of B vitamins, a valuable source of iron. And I think if we're going to replace the meat in a particular meal, then we need to deliver all of that, and that's our intention.
Do you think your product delivers that at the moment?
Yes, but I would say that I think that there's an opportunity for us, and this is an opportunity we've identified, to improve iron bioavailability. It's one thing, I think, to put iron in, which is what we're doing, to match the amount of iron in meat. I think that the science would tell you that meat is a very good source of bioavailable iron. But on the other hand, we also supply fibre, a good source of fibre, which you don't get in meat. And we know that that is an increasingly important part of our diets as we don't eat enough fruit and vegetables.
And that is V2 Food CEO Nick Hazel catching up with our reporter John Daly. What do you think of it? I mean, do you see this as a win-win? As Nick Hazel was just talking about, seeing it as an opportunity, really, for farmers who produce grains, legumes, that sort of thing. New market opportunity for farmers in those sort of areas, or do you see it a different way? Let me know in the text this afternoon, 0448 922 604. This just through, plant-based meats, it's full of salt and other additives and not so healthy, according to that text. And this text just through from one of the pastoralists here in Western Australia. Is there someone coming on to refute this rubbish? Thank you for that. 0448 922 604. A link to the story is on the ABC Rural Facebook page if you want to check out the story online. A lot of comments coming through too. This from John on the Facebook page. The question is why, other than to control the food market, highly processed foods have been and continue to be proven to be detrimental to human health. Grass-fed beef, lamb, pork and poultry are not only good for our nutritional needs, but if managed correctly, are good for the environment. And Shane agrees, stick to your lentils, you boring people. Why do they want to eat something that imitates meat? Leanne, they can go ahead and develop as many veggie patties as they want. Just allow me to have the choice of what I want to eat, but the less processed, the better. But I don't think Oz is going to be trying one of these new burgers. He says, I'll stick with my free-range, organic and ethical meat from hunting. Thanks. 0448 922 604 is the text to be part of the conversation. On the Country Hour, it's 12:15 and a few really hot days, hot in the north, but around the agricultural region, some really hot days this afternoon, I think getting up into those high 30s, 38 or so. We'll check in with the Bureau of Meteorology shortly. A little taste of summer this week, but still in spring, summer not too far away. And I guess a little reminder now about making sure that you're ready for the danger posed by fires. As you might have heard in the news today, bushfires are ravaging parts of northern New South Wales, with more than 30 homes destroyed or severely damaged. This is in areas around Rapville and Uinga. That part of New South Wales is currently in severe drought, so fires are causing all sorts of problems and heartache. For example, at a place called Drake, fires have burnt more than 78,000 hectares. About a month ago, a fire ripped through Edward Hart's property, burning more than 400 hectares, timber cattle yards, and also kilometres of his fencing. He says it could take years for his farm and cattle to fully recover from this. Edward Hart estimates the cost at around $100,000 to rebuild, buy in the fodder, and in lost production. And he says it could take years for his cattle to recover.
It all happened very, very quickly. We were trying to move cattle that morning, get them into safer paddocks down onto like river country where it's short grass. We knew they'd be a bit safer there. And trying to get the houses prepared and wet the garden and things like that, sort of last-minute preparations. But geez, it all happened very, very quickly. There's so much smoke, it was very hard to tell where the fire was coming from exactly and when it was going to hit. But yeah, it was about 1 o'clock and probably an hour later, it had jumped the road and was dropping sparks right next to the house, really, and it just became a case of abandon, trying to stop it getting through the property and just protect the houses and the sheds was all we could do.
How much damage did the fire actually do to the property?
Well, I think there's around about 1,000 acres that burnt. Very hard to put an exact figure on it, of course, but it goes in patches. But a lot of fencing has been burnt, and we've had 2 sets of timber yards burnt, and we think in the vicinity of about 15 kilometres of fencing that will have to be repaired, fairly extensively repaired, and 5 to 10 kilometres it'll be a total rebuild. It's just damage beyond repair, really.
So you've already started pulling out some of that damaged fencing?
Yeah, we have. Yep. We've been pretty busy doing that the last few weeks. We have been lucky enough to have a neighbour who has a small dozer, and he was great. He said, look, if you guys want some help, he'd come help us out. So that's been great. He started about a week ago, and he's been cleaning up a lot of the old fence lines because there were just fallen trees all over the place. Very hard to work to try and build a new fence and work machinery when there's just branches and trees everywhere. We've patched up what we can sort of quickly just to get a few paddocks stock proof, which has made things harder with the drought. Cattle were already hungry and we were already rationing the feed that we had, and now we've had to condense the cattle into the even smaller paddocks and trying to give them extra feed because what little feed they were getting in the paddocks is gone now. So that's sort of added an extra challenge on top, and some of those paddocks were very short on water and now it's even worse. Like some of those dams are nearly dry and we're about to start carting water to keep cattle going in some paddocks.
Are you now having to buy in more silage to feed your cattle?
We possibly will have to. We have a paddock of wheat that we were hoping to grow for grain, for our own cattle feed and to sell, basically something to get a bit of cash flow going. But with the dry, it's not going to make it through to grain, and we haven't been allowed to irrigate for quite a few months now. Yeah, that crop, we're just going to have to mow it, take what's there. Like, it's not very tall, but we'll just have to take what we can get and bale that. We had some help from local land services. They actually did send a truckload of hay to us, which has been a huge help. It was an emergency response to the fire. So we're feeding that to the cattle at the moment in the hope that it will rain in the next few months and we might get some grass growing.
What sort of impact is this fire likely to have on your animals?
I think it'll have a long-term impact. I think it'll take a few years, actually, for the effects to come through the pipeline sort of thing. I mean, the cattle were already not in great condition with the drought, and now losing even more of the pasture, or what was left of it really with the fire, they're just even hungrier. So we'll probably see a reduction in their fertility, and I mean, that is entirely what we do here is we breed calves. We don't fatten cattle or anything like that. We just breed calves and sell them at the wiener sales. So, if the cattle aren't in good health, they're not going to be cycling. They won't be going into calf this summer. and we'll see that next year, and we're going to have a lot less calves on the ground. It's going to make it that much harder to foot the bill for the rebuild process.
And so you're hoping to have Blaze Aid turn up here soon to help with putting up those fences?
Yeah, we had a visit from Blaze Aid, and they came and had a look around, and they said that they thought they would send some people down from Tenterfield. They got their base camp at Tenterfield, but they said they'd probably send some people down with caravans, and they'll stay at our place, and we said we're quite willing to provide the lunches and that sort of thing. So, yeah, that'll be great. I mean, we appreciate any help we can get. It's that thing that many hands make light work, I suppose.
Northern New South Wales farmer Edward Hart with Kim Honan, and he runs about 250 breeders and about 100 replacement stock, and just talking about that process after a fire goes through your place. At 20 past 12, let's stay in the eastern states for a little bit longer and talk about how becoming organically certified in the past has been quite an attractive option for graziers, partly because of the financial value that it adds to your products. But organically certified graziers on properties along the Lower Darling say they just aren't reaping any of the rewards of their licences. And they say the pressures caused by the drought mean they can't meet the conditions required to sell organic. Saskia Mabin spoke to grazier Wayne Smith.
We've lost our organic accreditation. Well, we've given it up. We can't guarantee organic status with the current situation with stock wandering backwards and forwards and the quality of the water.
Wayne Smith runs Karoola Station, a sheep grazing property on the Lower Darling River. While the river is mostly dry, he has no boundary fence. It's meant Mr. Smith can't sell his stock under the organic licence he owns and continues to pay for.
The biggest issue for us without this river is our containment of stock. They're wandering backwards and forward. We've got biosecurity issues with his sheep on my side, my sheep on his side. There's a huge situation for all the landholders along the Lower Darling. It's our fence, and currently we haven't got one. It's costing us, the bottom line, hip pocket everywhere.
It's a problem with no easy solution. Mr. Smith says building a fence along the river would be impossible.
It came as a huge surprise to everyone in government departments that this was actually a boundary fence, and people actually used it, for biosecurity reasons. It came as a huge surprise. I think, how are we going to fix that problem? We'll have to fence the river. Well, you can't put a fence down here, and if it does ever flood again, it's underwater, and up in the trees, you can't really go pushing them 500-year-old red gums out to try and get a fence through there somewhere, and it goes under the... Next time it floods, it's underwater.
It's not just the loss of the river as a fence that's preventing graziers from selling organic. John Clothier of Polier Station says sourcing organic feed during the drought is yet another challenge.
Without the biosecurity, drought of course on top of that, trying to source organic grain and hay is virtually impossible also. So we actually haven't sold anything organically for probably 3 years now.
It's caused a significant financial burden for his business.
Oh, it means quite a lot to our bottom line, for sure. You're picking up extra, dollar or so a kilo for the organic lamb job.
General Manager of Australian Certified Organic Sachin Ayarchit says the process to getting organic certification is long and rigorous.
To become certified organic, producers go through a comprehensive process of certification with an accredited certification body like ACO. Producers need to demonstrate at least 36 months of compliance with relevant standards before product can be sold as certified organic. Now, depending upon which export market product is sold or exported to, the producers may have to comply with more than one certification standard. The certification process itself includes the assessment of producers' organic management plan, an on-site organic audit, and a review of the audit findings before an organic certificate is issued.
While it is a substantial effort to become organically certified, Mr. Ayarchit says there are numerous financial and environmental benefits for producers.
I would summarise the value in three different points. First and foremost, I would say it is producers' assurance to consumers that the product is produced and processed in compliance with national and international organic standards. Secondly, the organic certification facilitates the market access to premium international markets like the US or Europe or Japan. Last but not the least, the organic certification process provides certification logos that are widely recognized by consumers. Certified organic producers become a part of a significantly growing organic industry, which is 13% annual growth industry, that produces products that are good not only for consumers, but also for the environment.
John Clothier would ideally like to keep his organic license, but with no end to the drought in sight, he says the burden of holding on to it might become too much to handle.
Plenty of paperwork and, yeah, there's, you know, a few $1,000 a year to keep it as well. So, yeah, when you're not actually using it, it makes you wonder whether we need it or not. If there's no improvements with this river in time to come, I think we'll probably end up dropping it, though. Yeah.
Crazier John Clothier with Saskia Mabin, 26 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
You remember we were talking, it was on Friday, about Australia's first trials of a new semi-autonomous road train, and those trials being conducted right here in Western Australia. Perth-based transport company Centurion is going to use the technology on long-haul trips into the Kimberley and also in the Pilbara. And the main aim of it all is to help manage driver fatigue and improve overall efficiency. Well, a national grain grower group is trying to develop a code of practice for these autonomous vehicles in agriculture. Grain Producers Australia hopes it will encourage manufacturers to invest in the development of autonomous machinery. And GPA Chairman Andrew Wiedemann thinks the absence of a code is slowing down the adoption of this technology.
Probably slowed down the adoption in the early days of the GPS systems, the global positioning systems that were used as well. So what we're trying to do is to speed up adoption and the investments that can potentially flow from the various companies globally around the world to invest in Australia and particularly in the automation area. And there's a need to put a code in place. We're talking about a voluntary code, not a mandatory code. I know that the car manufacturers' associations and others are looking at a mandatory code for autonomous vehicles as well, which has been happening for a while. But this is about putting something in place to, over time, and working with major investors in this area, being researchers and regional development corporations from the various commodities that would have a need, in particular, of course, the cotton industry, the wine industry and the horticultural industry that would be looking to use automation in their area as well.
So who would the code apply to?
Well, essentially we're looking at most plant-based industries. That's really what we're looking for.
So it would apply to the manufacturers and the users of the vehicles?
Look, absolutely. So they're the major component of this, obviously. So having something in place also that they would have to sign up to also allows for the insurance area, which is obviously a very big area of allowing autonomous vehicles to operate, that at least there's a code in place that can help alleviate some of the issues around not having insurance available for autonomous vehicles.
So is this a liability type issue and trying to avoid liability?
Look, it is in the long term, I suppose, but also ensuring that everybody works towards a certain framework, which is what the code is all about in terms of that broader outlook. And we're looking at hopefully trying to pull this together and put something out maybe towards the ABARES Outlook 2020 conference. It's something that we're looking at as a timeline to try and get it working. At the moment, we've put out a prospectus essentially to the regional development corporations, the machinery manufacturers themselves, and at the moment we're still waiting on calls back, but I can say the Tractor and Machinery Manufacturers Association has already signed on, as well as some of the peak industry bodies.
So you're developing a draft that would be put out for public comment?
For sure. I mean, that would be a part of it. There's certainly pulling it together and then opening it up for broader consultation with industry and obviously working with government around the potential implementation of this as well. I mean, it's got to start now, Angus, because I think a lot of people have been looking around for a while that autonomous tractors are in Australia and being worked on and developed and often being used now commercially in some areas, but we've got a lot of other things, particularly in the plant industries right across, as I said, the different commodities, cotton and sugar and wine and horticulture are all looking in this space as well at the moment about where they can look to improve their way that they produce food and produce commodities safely, but also with minimalising the issues around labour costs as well.
If I could ask you to speculate on what the landscape might look like maybe 10 years down the track, how common do you think autonomy will be then?
I think it will be commonplace in some of the more broad acre areas, I would think, at this stage. We're one of the first, in fact, one of the very few to have an auto-steer tractor back in 2000. And we've seen the development over the last 19 years of that. It's commonplace now. So I think if you look back historically on inventions and innovation, it tends to continue to keep a faster pace. So I would say that in 10 years' time, yes, we would see potentially autonomous tractors working in some of the larger paddocks out there. But, of course, we've got to make sure that we get the current environment right so that the investments flow and the confidence in our industry is here, that the manufacturers will come on board with that. And I think it's pretty crucial that we have that happen. The Tractor and Machinery Manufacturers Association getting on board really early proves that there is a need to try and make that work.
Andrew Wiedemann, he's the chair of Grain Producers Australia, talking to Angus Verley about how he thinks it'd be a great idea to have some sort of code of practice in place, which would sort of speed up the adoption of autonomous technology. On the Country Hour, 28 to 1, let's get the news headlines. Sandra Shaman-Burke is in the studio. Hello.
Hello, Bill. The WA government says a new initiative which links the Department of Education with the police force will help address school-related violence. An education officer will be placed within the police force to address violence and safety issues and provide support during serious incidents. WA police have charged two men over the bashing of a Mandurah woman in her own home last night. It's alleged the two men are known to the woman, entered her house just after 9 o'clock last night and assaulted her with a baseball bat. WorkSafe WA is urging people to take precautions ahead of the warmer weather to prevent heat stress or heat stroke. Temperatures this summer have been forecast to be above average across the country. And star AFL midfielder Tim Kelly says he and his family are ecstatic to be in Perth after West Coast picked him up from Geelong. Kelly came in exchange for picks 14, 24 and 37 in this year's draft, along with the Eagles' first pick next year. Bell, I'll be back at one with the full bulletin.
Thank you for that, Sandra. 27 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Very shortly, taking you off to the Landor races. Have you been before? What's your best memory of the Landor races? It's been going for years now and probably will be forever. 0448 922 604 is the text if you've got a story to tell. And we'll also check on mutton prices in the eastern states. Prices never seen before at this time of year. Apparently being driven by what's going on in China with the pig situation, the African swine fever wiping out pigs, and China needed to getting its protein from somewhere else. So more sheep meat, apparently, heading over to China. And we'll get the results of the Katanning Sheep Market too with Tracy Kilner just before taking you back to the Allen Border Field in Brisbane for the rest of the match, Australia playing Sri Lanka in the cricket, the women's cricket. Right now it's off to the Weather Bureau. Adam Conroy with you. Adam, we'll start in northern and eastern parts.
Yeah, so generally dry over a lot of the north and east of the state. Been some reasonably fresh winds as well and quite high temperatures, so a fair bit of fire weather, bad fire weather conditions going through most northern parts of the state and also down through the inland Gascoyne and Goldfields. We could see one or two thunderstorms develop this afternoon over the far northern Kimberley, very little in that, and beyond today, that activity is likely to cease as some dry air moves all the way up to the North Kimberley coast. Looking at tomorrow, a similar sort of day in terms of fire weather conditions, are still remaining quite hot, with some reasonably fresh easterly to northeasterly winds tending more north-northwesterly down in the goldfield. So likely we'll have a fair area of bad fire weather tomorrow, and that'll extend a bit further down through the goldfields and into the Eucla. Only weather possible tomorrow is there might be a little bit of mid-level thunderstorm activity just out in the Eucla in the early morning, but probably nothing reaching the ground out of that. Now moving into Friday, looks all clear in northern and eastern parts, but then on Saturday we're going to get a mid-level disturbance move over southern parts of the state. So initially a lot of that will be in the southwest land division, but during Saturday we should see some showers and even possible thunderstorms extend through the southern Gascoyne, through the goldfields and into the Eucla. Looks likely then on Sunday that activity probably initially in the southeast Gascoyne goldfields and Eucla, and then contracting away southeast during the day.
All right, let's move into the Southwest Land Division and some pretty hot temperatures for this time of year this afternoon.
That's right. So we're getting up into the high 30s. The hottest conditions are out through the central wheat belt. So I see we're around 37 at Southern Cross at the moment, and even some sort of temperatures in the low 30s getting down through inland parts of the southeast coastal district. So it is quite warm at the moment. Tomorrow we'll see a slight drop in temperatures through most parts as a trough moves a bit further east, but still getting up into the mid-30s through eastern parts of the central wheat belt and inland parts of the southeast coastal district. Near the west coast, we'll have some pretty humid conditions in the morning, so there'll probably be some fog up and down the west coast that'll then clear up to a mostly sunny day. As we head into Friday, we do get this mid-level disturbance start to develop, so showers mostly by the afternoon will be developing roughly southwest of the line from Perth down to about Hopetown. Bulk of the activity will be really sort of Mandurah to just east of Albany. It does look like there might be the odd thunderstorm in it. So although falls might be quite patchy, there'll probably be some areas that get up to around 10 millimetres during Friday afternoon and evening down in the southwest. Then on Saturday, it will extend through the southwest land division, but by this stage, we'll probably be getting a bit more patchiness to the activity, but it should extend all through except maybe the far north of the central west and through the central wheat belt, great southern, and down towards the southeast coastal district. There might even be the odd thunderstorm in it as well. So if you're under one of those, you could potentially get a little drop of rain, but otherwise probably a bit more patchy away from those areas. Temperatures by that stage will also start to drop as we get the rain moving through and some cloud cover. So by then, pretty much everywhere will be much cooler than what we've had. Temperatures down near the south coast and around 17 or 18 degrees, grading up to the low 20s by the time you're up in the central wheat belt, and mid-20s up in the central west. Then on Sunday, it looks like we'll see any shower and thunderstorm activity that was around on Saturday start to contract further east. So probably still lingering in the southeast coastal district for at least the morning period on Sunday. But otherwise, once that sort of clears up, we'll just really be left with a few showers near the south coast, just down in an onshore flow, and temperatures once again remaining a bit more mild.
All right, and warnings this afternoon, then. Adam, what have you got for us?
So the fire weather warning for today is pretty much all of northern WA and down through the inland Gascoyne, and also just creeping into the far east of the central wheat belt, and sort of tomorrow similar sort of conditions up north, but also likely to have fire weather warnings through the goldfields and Eucla. Out on the waters, generally not too bad around the state. We just have a strong wind warning for the Eucla coast.
Great, thank you for the update. It is 21 to 1, no rainfall over 5 millimetres anywhere across the state in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Taking you back to the Allen Border Field at 1 o'clock today. This is for the match that's on right now. It's between the Australian women and Sri Lanka. It is the third one-day international. Sri Lanka scored 8 for 195, and in reply, Australia is now none for 86. So the Australian women's team needs another 110 runs with 10 wickets and 38 overs remaining. Taking you back to Brisbane, right at the top of the clock at 1 o'clock today. Right now, you are off to the races. Almost 1,000 people from around Western Australia hit the road and made their way to the Eastern Gascoigne. This is over the weekend. The Landor Races are one of only two amateur race meets left in the state, and after almost 100 years, they've become an iconic event in the north. Our reporter Michelle Stanley was there to take it all in.
You could drive past the Landor Racetrack 360 days of the year and you'd be lucky to see a bungara. But the first weekend in October, Landor comes alive. 270 kilometres northwest of Meekatharra and 1,000 kilometres northeast of Perth, the Landor Races would have to be one of the most remote race meets in the country. And if you ask the locals, also one of the most iconic.
Oh, look, I honestly think it's just, it's infectious. Once something gets in your blood, it's very hard to stop. I've raced horses, I've won cups, I've won a bracelet. I don't know, it's like, I suppose, being a member of a football club. If you get passionate enough about it, it's not a problem, put it that way.
Brian O'Dwyer has been going to Landor for 55 years and he sat on the committee of the Eastern Gascoigne Race Club for 51.
There's probably none other really authentic race meeting in West Australia as such as Landor. I mean, I know there's Coolin, but I mean, Landor has been, the roots have started in 1921 and virtually the theme of the format of Landor really hasn't changed. It's still, we've still got some of our own rules that they're grass-fed horses or they can be corn-fed nowadays, but we've got our club rules of where the horses have to be in a paddock for 6 months prior to the race meeting and can't have started. So there is a bit of uniqueness about it. And I think because it's where it is and the facilities that are available, they sit here all year vacant and come alive for 1 week of the year. It's definitely unique in my opinion. The first race today, the Mount Augusta's maiden plate, it was originally for maiden horses but stock horses and they had to be ridden in stock saddles. They all carried 83 kilos and that was to maintain the tradition of how the Landor races all started back in 1921 with a group of stockmen and station managers getting together and trying to find out who had the fastest horse. So that was the foundation of it. And so that race is still virtually what you would call a blue ribbon race, despite the fact that it's been changed slightly, that they race in pads now and it's weighted. It's still got that old-fashioned ring about it.
It's a three-day event. There are races on Saturday, a Gymkhana Sunday and the Cup Day Monday. There's even a ball on the Saturday night. It's a bush race in every sense. There are no barriers, you sleep in your swag, and there's plenty of red dust. But there are some luxuries.
Well, it's definitely come a fair way in the latter years. Originally, this camp we're in front of now, which is a Woodlands camp, it was a Woodlands Milgan camp. It was, like all the rest of them, it was made out of mulga uprights and mulga roof or mulga rails on the roof covered in brush. And it, over the years, as people have sort of had to refurbish their camps, it's gone, as you can see, gone to steel and corrugated iron. And the chandelier in our camp is, yeah, that's a bit of a luxury, but, you know, you try to, well, as you can see, there's nothing here when you arrive on the Wednesday or the Thursday and all of a sudden it becomes a city of tents and canvas and a chandelier, and it's just like being at home. Not that we've got chandeliers at home, I must admit.
But whether you were once a local like Brian O'Dwyer or are just passing through, everyone seems to agree there is that one thing that makes Landor so special.
Catching up with genuine country people. Yeah, and then you meet new people. You always meet new people. That's good.
The friendly people. just the atmosphere here is just, yeah, really good.
The races and the people up here are just absolutely fantastic. You know, I mean, they're so friendly. There's no mess at all. Everyone's picking up rubbish. The place is spotless all the time. The kids are well behaved.
Landors, I think, the sort of thing that makes this world, and if there was more landors around the place, the world would be a far better place.
Country racing across WA has been struggling for some time, and despite its reputation, Landor isn't immune. With its unique amateur rules, the meet relies on local pastoralists to put their horses in for the races. But with many stations moving slowly away from working with horses, some are concerned the field will dry up and this iconic event will see its end. But the president of the race club, Don Hammerquist, he's got some faith.
In our property, we don't use horses for stock work either. Basically mechanically operated for livestock mustering. That strength here still exists because some people that come and go out of the country still train a horse, whether they live in Geraldton or Meekatharra or, you know, in the outer regions, and still keep coming back to Landor with those horses. I think it's, like gold fever. People have Landor fever.
What do you think has been the key to its success for a race meet in WA? There are very few that have lasted this long.
A huge secret to the success of this race club is the voluntary nature of, you know, the community. That we can say committee, but it's broader than that. We have busy bees here in early part of the year, where we have up to 30 people come along and volunteer their time, machinery, etc. to put in an ablution block or do some extensions or tidy up maintenance issues purely on a voluntary basis. I mean, that's true grit, that's confidence, that's commitment, that's, you know, to what we're all about here. Yeah, and the racing is sensational. Let's hope that the next generation of people that come along that are going to be running the club, that we've left it in good hands, or safe hands, and forward-thinking hands to keep the club going for a long, long time.
In 2 years, Landor Races will be celebrating its 100th year, and people are expected to come from far and wide. And after experiencing Landor firsthand myself, I plan to join them.
Michelle Stanley ending that report from the 2019 Landor Races, which finished up on Monday in the Eastern Gascoyne. Did you get along? Have you got a great memory to share about this iconic bush event? 0448 922 604. Well, the talk of the Landor Races triggered one memory for Brian Bush, and he's called through to talk to us on the Country Hour today. Brian, what happened to you? Because this goes back a little while, doesn't it?
Yes, it's back in the 1980s, and I was heading out to the Berengarra Aboriginal community out at Mount Augustus, and I was heading west from Meekatharra, and I got to the Yorilla Creek, and there's a metre of water across it, and it's only like a causeway. There's no way in the world I was going to get across it. So I parked up and rolled up my swag and, you know, grabbed a beer and sat back and relaxed. I thought I might be stuck here for a while. I'd put a stick in to measure the drop of the river, but there was no rain. It came down, you know, down the river from further out. But while I'm sitting there, a little light plane, you know, a little Cessna or something. I don't know my planes, but it landed on the road. Bloke gets out. He comes over. He says, "You all right, mate?" And I told him this story. He says, "Oh, no worries. I'll get back to the station and I'll give Berengarra a ring and let him know you're a little bit delayed."
Do you remember who flew down to check if you're okay?
No, I don't. Back, you know, 30-odd years ago. But it was funny because the Aboriginal people came out to get me across the creek. Well, they took me. You know, I'm driving a Falcon, not a four-wheel drive back in those days. And they took me up the creek, got me across, got me into the community. No worries, I did my job, and then I couldn't get back out. Well, when I got back out to the Yorilla, the water had hardly dropped, and I relied on a roof shooter from Landor who was living in a little humpy on the Meekatharra side to tow me across because he was going into the community to get some tobacco. Well, he didn't have to go into the community, so I gave him a pack of mine. It saved me life that day.
And did you ever get to the races while you were working out in this part of Western Australia?
Well, I tend to avoid races. I tend to avoid people. They get me into trouble. I mean, I won't stay in a donga. Sometimes the guys will buy me a beer and I'll be so inebriated I can't even find me donga, so I've got to curl up under a tree. So I usually camp by myself these days. Now I'm an old bloke and I don't get into too much trouble.
Oh, well, you did really well all those years ago. What, 30 years ago? And isn't it great that someone just, you know, flew the plane down just to check on you and see if everything was okay?
Oh, bloody terrific. I mean, you know, even the greater driver, yeah, he's not going to town because the wife might have a maintenance order out on him. So he stays camping in his humpy in the bush grading the road, and they'll always flag you down so they can have a yarn and catch up on the latest news, you know. And they'll usually give you a beer while they're talking to you, so if you don't mind keeping them talking.
Brian, it's really lovely to hear from you. Thank you for ringing through and sharing that story with us. Just getting stuck out on the way to a job. People come in, had a similar experience myself just last week. Got the husband and the children out of a spot of bother with people just so happy to help in that part of the world. This is the Country Hour. It's 10 minutes to 1 o'clock. We will get to the market shortly, the results of the Katanning sheep market for you. Tracy Kilner is going to go through the yarding and the prices for you just before taking you back to the cricket, Australia playing Sri Lanka in Brisbane. Let's have a talk about mutton prices now, because what's happening is that China's need for protein in the wake of this African swine fever is really driving up Australia's mutton prices. Meat processors are buying Cull Ewes and Wethers at prices that haven't been seen before at sale yards during the springtime. This is happening in the eastern states. We'll get to the Katanning sheep market results shortly. But James Hadrick is a Victorian-based livestock agent with HF Richardson, and these are his observations.
Historically, for this time of the year, they're the highest they've probably ever been.
So at the Ballarat market today, what did prices do?
Consistently, sheep mutton prices were probably mid-$6 range up to $7, and some sales probably eclipsing $7 a kilo.
And how does this compare to this time in previous years?
Oh, well, it doesn't compare at all because we've never seen it before. So, yeah, the comparison is that generally at this time of the year, we're probably seeing sort of, well, if you take it back 12 months ago, probably nearly $1.50, $2 a kilo less.
So restockers aren't operating because of the prices?
There's limited opportunities out there for the restockers to purchase any of the stock that comes into the fat market. That being that they're making more than what they're willing to pay at this stage.
So who are purchasing these expensive sheep?
The meatworks are taking nearly 100% of the stock.
There was a large run today at the Ballarat market of over 600 Wethers, I think they were, that made $145. Are we expecting to see prices like this going forward?
I'd say so, yeah, given the way that the season's shaping up and the limited amount of sheep that are going to be through the north of Australia, I can see that the mutton market's going to remain strong and so those orders are going to continue into the spring and summer and autumn.
So what are those people who would otherwise use this time to restock because of the good season? What are they choosing to do instead?
Some of the restockers are restocking with lambs, prime lambs or merino wether lambs, but they've been probably historic highs too for the season and the year. Yeah, the opportunist buys aren't there, like the people that might have had a bit of grass and that they might have wanted to eat it down and they thought they'd go and buy a couple of hundred wethers or whatever. There's not the money in it to do it, hence they're sitting on their hands.
Mercado market analyst Matt Dalgleish says this price lift has been coming.
The last few years, what has been driving it has been the general growth in China and the wealth in China, the middle class wealth has been underlying. But in this last period, so say since the start of this year, there's been another dynamic hit the market, and that's really been the result of this African swine fever that's really taking a lot of pork product out of China, and Chinese consumers are looking for substitute products, and one of those is our mutton and lamb product.
Are you able to put some numbers around the exports that are going out of Australia to China?
Yes, so if you look at, say, comparatively this current season to the five-year average through the season, for mutton we're around about 108% above the five-year average. For lamb, I think we're about 65% or thereabouts above the five-year average. So, yeah, significant numbers. And even, I mean, through the winter we saw a little bit of a reduction in volume, you know, compared to early in the year. but that was still above the average even with that reduction, and that was because of the high prices we had through winter and the low supply. But just from July to September for mutton, there's been a 208% increase in volume just in those last 2 months of mutton flow, so it's taken off again with a big resurgence.
Traditionally, mutton hasn't been overly expensive during spring, and some people take the opportunity to, you know, restock with some older sheep. What's happening in this space?
The export market is really driving the prices, and that's probably going to continue through to the rest of this year, and I wouldn't be surprised if we even see strong volumes going overseas into next year, given the size of the protein gap. The normal seasonal period when you see those really cheap prices of mutton, I think it's unlikely to see it this year, and we might not even see them next year. So it's for those that are wanting to restock, it's going to get fairly expensive, I think, and you're not going to have much respite.
Matt Dalgleish, he's a market analyst with Mercado, talking to Simone Smith. Just recapping those prices again that we heard from James Hadrick, that Victorian-based livestock agent, talking about what happened at Ballarat. The sheep mutton prices between $6 to $7 a kilogram, and as he was saying, some over that $7 a kilogram mark. At Katanning today, the heavy weather's average between $3.96 and $4.40 per kilogram. Tracy Kilner is going to go through those details for you of the Katanning market in just a moment or two. But I was curious to know about what's going on with African swine fever and all those pigs being decimated in China, and that really driving up the prices of mutton and the demand for sheep meat products going into China. So I was just doing a bit of a ring around today to the different exporters of sheep meat products from Western Australia into China. I think there are three of those, or maybe four licences now from WA into China. V&V Walsh, Fletcher's, Wamco, three I can think of right now. But I'd be curious to know whether the demand has picked up here in WA, and whether or not we've got enough sheep in this state to sort of increase production, if there is the demand, the increased demand coming from China, whether or not we can actually fill those orders. So I'll make a few more calls this afternoon and see what we can find out. But if you know something about that, text through now and let me know. 0448 922 604 is the text. Shortly, at 1 o'clock, taking you back to the cricket, back to Brisbane. This is the third one-day international. It's the women's game, Australia playing Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka scored 8 for 195. And in reply, Australia, none for 113 off just 16 overs. So the women are really motoring along in a rush to get that cup of tea. Elisa Healy is getting even more runs today. She scored 71 of 45 balls. So Australia needs another, I think this is not quite updated, 83 runs to win off 34 overs and still got those 10 wickets up their sleeve. Taking you back to the Allan Border Field in Brisbane for the rest of the game at 1 o'clock today. Right now, though, let's get to the markets. And today it's the Katanning sheep market. About 12,350 sheep sold at Katanning today. So a very similar size yarding to last week's. Tracy Kilner is at the Katanning sale yards. Tracy, did the prices hold up today?
All processing sheep remained firm, while the stores and lightweight lines were in demand from restocker and feeder buyers. Heavy new season lambs topped the market at $170 a head to return 668 cents a kilo, while restockers paid the top money of $135 for a pen of medium weight ewes carrying a 15 mil fleece. The lightweight new season lambs under 16 kilos carcass weight made from $46 to $100, while over 16 kilos carcass weight sold for $92 to $116 a head. Merino weather lambs with a fleece made $121 to restockers. Trade weight lambs sold for $100 to $140 for the lighter weights, while the heavier tradies returned $135 to $149 a head. The heavy lambs sold for $160 to $170 a head. Young ewes made from $40 to $100 for lightweights under 18 kilos carcass weight and $87 to $120 for the heavier, better quality ewes, including skins. The light store boning ewes eased, selling for $50 to $88, while the heavier store ewes returned $80 to $105 a head. Medium weight prime ewes in the 18 to 23 kilo carcass weight range sold from $95 to $135, carrying a 15 mil fleece. Good quality heavy mutton over 24 kilos. Carcass weight remained mostly firm on last week, making from $98 to $135 a head. Young Merino Wethers were up on demand, selling for $52 to $121 a head. Older Wethers eased on lightweights but remained firm on the heavy pen, selling for $80 to $149 a head. Mature rams sold for $20 to $110, averaging $60, while the ram lambs made from $61 to $142, depending on quality and weights, to average $120 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you for that. Tomorrow, this time on the Country Hour, you're off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market. I think Tracy Kilner will be going through that for you too. Just to recap the story we started talking about at the top of the hour today, the fact that Australian fast food giant Hungry Jack's is launching this plant-based alternative that tries to replicate the exact taste and the texture of its beef burgers. That story's up online. An easy way to get there is to just go to the ABC Rural Facebook page and you can click the link there. That's it for the Country Hour today. Wanting to take you back now to the Allan Border Field at Brisbane. This is for the Australian women's cricket match between Australia and Sri Lanka. And to pick up with the commentary, taking you there now with Corbin Middlemass.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.